football, and politics. I don't think we know Jonas Salk. The name doesn't really ring a bell. Jonas Salk is a person who developed polio vaccine for everyone free of charge. All of us are indebted to him, but we just don't know him. On the other hand, there are many people who may not know Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Or, for example, we don't know the name of the president of Gabon. Actually, most of us don't know anything about Gabon, but we know Aubameyang, the Gabonese football player. This is a rule. Football players are the most famous people. People, even in far-fetched places in the world, love football, and they follow everything about football. You only need to be in the first layer of football. Then everyone in the world will fix their eyes on you, and everyone in the world will know you. Football is the key to fame. Football is the key to popularity. Fame and popularity will bring power and wealth. This is what subconsciously draws politicians to football.
The 45-year-old is the third richest person in the UK with an estimated fortune of over £10 billion. He bought Chelsea Football Club in 2003 and has the ear of the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who got extremely rich after the collapse of the Soviet Union and about the power struggles in modern Russia.
The name of many politicians in the world are so tightly intertwined with football that people in the world can hardly remember their political designation. For example, not many people remember Roman Abramovich, the owner of the Chelsea Club, was once a member of the Russian parliament, the Duma, or was a governor of a district in Russia. Many people in the world know Silvio Berlusconi, not a powerful former Italian prime minister, but as the owner of AC Milan Club. Many people don't care the current owner of the Manchester City Club is the vice president of the cabinet of minister of the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and this is not the entire story. Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia, played football in friendly and local matches in front of thousands of his supporters and those who voted for him.
Sadi is sort of the black sheep of the Gaddafi family. He tried to enter professional football or soccer in Italy. He played one game for Perugia, but then failed a drug test.
Sadi, Gaddafi's third son, left no stone unturned so he could play in Calcio. And the legendary Fidel Castro loved to spend time with Maradona, a world-class legend of football. Many politicians are directly engaged in the game of football. The story doesn't end here. Political parties and groups love to use the popularity of great football players to achieve power. For example, Kaja Khaled, AC Milan's robust defense, was elected as the mayor of Tbilisi. Before that, George Weah, the legendary striker of Milan, became the president of Liberia. Brazil's Romário became a member of parliament in his country. Before that, Hakan Şükür, the renowned Turkish forward, was voted to become a member of parliament. In 2008, when Roman Pavlyuchenko was scoring a goal against Edwin van der Sar like this, he had been voted as a member of the Duma in Russia. Sometimes it's the football players themselves who use people to guarantee that their people's political goals will be fulfilled. For example, Dr. Socrates, with his memorable goals against Russia or Italy, he was a genius who would sometimes wear headbands with political slogans on them. He would also wear shirts with political slogans and would fight the military dictatorship in Brazil like a revolutionary. Or Lillian Thuram, who made interviews in support of immigrants and black people and those who live in shanty towns in France. He had vitriolic words for then French president.
When you are the president of the Republic of France, you can make speeches like Mr. Sarkozy did in Dakar, for example, when he explained that black people had never made a mark on history. It was a racist speech.
Or Didier Drogba, who used his popularity to help stop the civil war in the Ivory Coast. Football and politics are twins. No politician could ignore a weapon named football, and when insignificant clubs and less famous players can have remarkable political roles and influence, it's only natural that the World Cup turns into a major opportunity for political campaigns. Millions of people are glued to the games for a month. The headlines of all media are about this big event. All cameras in the world are directed towards the World Cup. It's the best opportunity to be seen, to be known, to become popular, and to gain power and influence. That's why most of the great politicians, one way or another, pretend that they're involved with the World Cup. That's why politicians try to direct the World Cup.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The game of the politicians for the World Cup starts from the time of selecting the host. They meet FIFA officials. They discuss with other heads of states. They deliver speeches and advertise. They spend their money, fame, and credit. Even in some cases, they might spend illegal money to be chosen as the host. Being chosen as a host means economic boosts, increase in popularity, and to a great deal, guaranteeing the political future. It's natural that people in a country are satisfied with the politicians who take the most important event to their country. But what if they're not the host?
Landon, what do we got? I hope you guys caught that. That doesn't happen very often. Okay, and what do we got here? That's me.
Well, in that case, they meet the players and the national team coach as a first stage. Almost almost all presidents and prime ministers take a sneak peek at the national team preparations before they go for the competitions. They take as many pictures as they can and record videos with famous players and announce their support for the representatives of their country to the world. And now, they have to show themselves in the World Cup. They enter the stadium and sit right next to each other in the VIP stands and show themselves so worried or happy so everyone knows that there is nothing more important for them than their national team. If they can't take part in person, they record a video message.
Man, I just wanted to call and say you guys did us proud.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys captured the hearts and imaginations of the whole country. It's unbelievable.
Well, we heard you were watching, and we know how big a supporter you are, so hopefully we made you proud. It was our honor, as it always is, to represent our country.
All right, appreciate you guys. Safe travels back.
Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Sometimes they even make controversial interviews about the incidents during the World Cup. For example, after Suarez was dismissed and Uruguay was defeated by Colombia, then-President Jose Mujica took part in the ceremony to commemorate the Uruguayan football star and in an interview branded FIFA officials as a bunch of sons of who defeated his country's team on purpose. It's true, an all-out political show takes place on the sidelines of the World Cup. That's why politicians get extremely happy over their team's ascent to the World Cup. The World Cup gives them plenty of opportunities so they can promote their status or stabilize it, or at least it gives them an opportunity to show themselves to the world.
And the break is on Amiri. Osmoun's through on goal. Here he can put it round ahead. It's Osmoun! It's a splendid save into Handbash.
The first achievement is getting closer to the citizens. Ordinary people are crazy about football. They love their national team. Victory, pride, and their flag is more important than anything else for them. When the president of a country watches people's favorite team just like them, it can mean that he's part of the people. He has the same interests and obsessions, and he will do anything so their favorite team, namely the favorite team of his fellow citizens, will win. This public belief is a major point in the minds of voters in the next elections and in the mind of the people in other countries who consider it as a symbol of a nation. Besides all of this, participation of a country in the World Cup and its success during the games will change everything in that country. Public joy and spirit, unity among the people, and even satisfaction with the standard of living. Politicians love the World Cup. They use this opportunity to achieve their goals, and this is one of the reasons of the theory that the World Cup is a political phenomenon. Yes, it's one of the reasons.
It's Jerdan Shaqiri now for Switzerland. Can he win it? Shaqiri scores! What a turnaround from Switzerland! One goal down at the break. They have now scored twice in this second half.
The other reason is politics has always imposed itself on the World Cup throughout history. The competitions have always been a symbolic scene for conflicting political forces. It's a rich political history. The 1934 World Cup was held in Italy. Mussolini, the fascist leader of Italy at the time, would go to the stadium, becoming the champion was so important for Mussolini that he did whatever it took to achieve that. He even invited the referee who would officiate the Italy-Austria match to a private party on the eve of the game. The flamboyant closing ceremony of that edition of the World Cup was held in a completely nationalistic atmosphere. Political tinge was obvious in the next World Cup as well. When the national anthem of Italy was being played, the Italian players hailed like fascists as a military unit. On the other hand, the German team was a combination of German and Austrian players, 7 German players, and 4 Austrian players, because the same year, Hitler had managed to annex Austria to German territory. That year, Italy became the champion for a 2nd time. Mussolini achieved everything he wanted from football, nationalistic passion, joy, pride, public excitement, and unity. Later on, in the 1954 World Cup, Bern was a realm of muscle flexing for Germans. Only 9 years after a war that ruined the country, the Germans showcased their indefatigable and fighting spirit. In the strangest final match in history, they defeated Hungary in a dreamlike comeback and revived their national pride that had been trampled upon. Now, the defeated Germany had something to take pride in, a symbol of the uprising of a country that had lost everything it had. In the following World Cups, football turned into a symbol of rivalry between the East and West. The Eastern Bloc countries try to flaunt the orderly structure and teamwork in their societies within their teams as well. For them, football was a battle. It was an arena to prove that their philosophical and political beliefs were correct. In the 1958 World Cup, the Soviet Union defeated Britain, and North Korea became a phenomenon in 1966 and defeated powerful Italy 1-0. Later on, in the playoff match in 1974, the Soviet Union had to play against Chile. The political officials of the Communist Party decided not to play in Chile as a protest. Pinochet, the Western-backed dictator, had just orchestrated a coup, and the Santiago Stadium had turned into the biggest political prison in the world. FIFA announced the result 3-0 in favor of Chile. As ordered by General Pinochet, the Chilean players were in the field and were attacking the Soviets' empty goal. Chile took part in the 1974 World Cup. The confrontation between the East and West reached its climax when the two swaths of the post-war Germany, namely the East and the West, played against each other. Afterwards, politicians came up with the idea of changing the results. There are strange but unconfirmed reports about match fixing in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. General Jorge Videla, the Argentine dictator back then, and Morales Peros, the Peruvian president, they say the Argentine government forcibly disappeared some of the Peruvian dissidents, exactly the way it would deal with its own dissidents. In return, Peru received 6 goals in a suspicious match and paved the path for Argentina to become champion. The dictator back then needed it to calm the public. Four years later, in the 1982 World Cup, fixing the outcome by political authorities did not need any conspiracy. When Kuwait received the 4th goal from France, a Kuwaiti official got into the field and kicked a fuss and threatened that he'd get his team off the field. The fuss yielded a result. Referee disallowed the goal, and the raging politician went back to the stands.
The World Cup is beloved across our planet because it offers a chance for people from around the world to be judged not by the place they grew up, the color of their skin, or the way they choose to worship, but by their spirit, skill, and strength.
And finally, one of the most politically charged games in the history of the World Cup, the match between Iran and the U.S.
As we cheer today's game between American and Iranian athletes, I hope it can be another step toward ending the estrangement between our nations.
Let's not forget that the World Cup is not just a sports event. It's part of a political process for politicians to gain power and popularity. Let's not forget that only with a little attention, we could see that the World Cup, with all of the issues that surround it, is a tool in the hands of different governments to push their goals forward. Let's not forget that every minor incident in the World Cup might affect the political fate of millions of people. And the exciting and attractive games of the World Cup can be more than a simple football match. For example, it might be a political battlefield for two countries or two political schools. Let's remember that political powers affect the World Cup, and the World Cup affects political powers. This time, we can view it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After two decades that have passed since the beginning of the illegal occupation of Afghanistan by American, British, and NATO forces, new dimensions of the crimes of the invaders are publishing every day. In one of them, the British ministers recently have announced an inquiry into charges of more than 50 summary killings by Special Air Service soldiers in Afghanistan, a decision made after years of reports that British occupying troops killed civilians in cold blood. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay tuned. The website of Euronews writes, Britain's military has announced it will launch an inquiry into reports that its special forces carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Junior Defense Minister Andrew Morrison said in the House of Commons on Thursday, December 15th, that the UK Ministry of Defense, MOD, would concede to long-standing demands for an independent statutory inquiry. BBC reported earlier this year that British Elite Special Air Service, SAS, killed Afghan civilians in cold blood. Morrison admitted the Afghanistan inquiry, which is to start in early 2023, will focus on unlawful killings by the British Special Forces during deliberate detention operations in Afghanistan from mid-2010 to mid-2013. It will also examine the adequacy of subsequent investigations by the Ministry of Defense in two charges of wrongdoing, including murder. However, Morrison noted the inquiry will ensure that all service personnel, veterans and current and former civil servants who are asked to engage with the inquiry will be given full legal and pastoral support. The announcement follows reports that 54 Afghans were killed in suspicious circumstances by one SAS unit in Helmand province between 2010 and 2011 and charges that this amounted to war crimes. Tessa Gregory from the UK law firm, which is representing the families of the deceased, said an inquiry should have been launched years ago. She said the charges of extrajudicial killings and cover-up are of such gravity and the concerns expressed contemporaneously within the British and Afghan army and by a reputable international organization working on the ground in Afghanistan were so serious and so widespread that an inquiry should have been instituted by the government years ago. The families of eight people, including three young boys reportedly murdered by British Special Forces in two separate operations during night raids in Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012, welcomed the inquiry, saying they waited 10 years for justice. One of the family members said, over 10 years ago, I lost two of my brothers, my young brother-in-law, and a childhood friend, all boys with a life ahead of them, adding, I was handcuffed, beaten, and interrogated outside our family home by British troops. My relatives and friends were each shot in the head as they sat drinking tea. The family member said my family had waited 10 years to find out why this happened. Meanwhile, The Guardian Daily reports ministers have announced a statutory judge-led inquiry into allegations of more than 50 summary killings by SAS soldiers in Afghanistan, a decision made after years of reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood. In a statement to the House of Commons, Andrew Morrison, the Minister for Defence, said Lord Justice Haddon Cave would take on the job and work would start in earnest in 2023. Haddon Cave will stand down for his job as a senior presiding judge for England and Wales to focus on the task. John Healy, the Shadow Defence Secretary, said this special inquiry is welcome and must succeed. It is essential to protect the reputation of our British Special Forces, guarantee the integrity of military investigations, and secure justice for any of those affected. A high court case brought by the law firm Lay Day on behalf of one man, Saifullah, charged that his father, two brothers and a cousin were killed during an SAS raid on a compound in southern Afghanistan in February 2011. It was called Objective Tyburn by the SAS, referring to a historic place of execution in London. Evidence from disclosures required by the courts indicated that Afghan men detained on SAS night raids were often separated from their families and shot dead after they were claimed to have unexpectedly produced a hand grenade or an AK-47 rifle. Saifullah legal team sought a judicial review, arguing that the MOD did not properly investigate charges of unlawful activity and that Britain had breached its human rights obligations by not properly examining them. Internal correspondence revealed that a Special Air Services Sergeant Major described the episode as the latest massacre. In an email sent the following morning after the report on a mission that led to the deaths of Saifullah family members was filed, concerns about SAS activity in Afghanistan have been circling around the MOD for years, but criminal investigations were closed 3 years ago without any prosecutions being brought. In 2014, military police launched Operation Northmoor, an investigation into charges of more than 600 offences by British occupation forces in Afghanistan, including the killing of innocent civilians by the SAS. It was wound down in 2017 and closed in 2019, and the MOD said no evidence of criminality was found. The website of Al Jazeera writes the BBC reported following its own four-day probe, unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids. The weapons were planted on them to justify the crimes. The Ministry of Defense said in a statement it will also scrutinize the adequacy of the response by the Ministry of Defense, MOD, to the concerns raised about the troops' conduct and assess what lessons can be learned. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said in a statement, "If there are fair lessons to learn, it is right that we consider those fully to ensure all charges are handled appropriately and in equal measure." Wallace said the MOD had made a number of changes in recent years to deal with serious allegations of wrongdoing, including the creation of a Defense Serious Crime Unit. The BBC's Panorama program investigation said senior officers, including General Mark Carlton Smith, who headed UK Special Forces at the time, were aware of concerns within the SAS about the operations but failed to report them to military police. Under UK law governing the armed forces, it is a criminal offence for commanding officers to fail to inform the military police if they become aware of potential war crimes. In July, before the broadcast of one such program, the MOD accused the broadcaster of engaging in irresponsible, incorrect journalism by being prepared to air the charges in the first place. However, within 24 hours of that statement, there were signs of a change of heart. Military police began a fresh investigation into the charges, in which the BBC and other organizations were asked to share information, and which led to the recent statement.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The recent UN climate summit in Egypt offered more brazen hypocrisy than usual because the world's rich countries once again lectured poor nations about the dangers of fossil fuels as they continue to use massive amounts of new gas, coal, and oil. An African climate change activist speaks here on the sidelines of the summit.
We have had several conferences of the parties on the continent, at least four of them. Each time they say it's African COP, but at the end of the day, it doesn't have the aspirations, the decisions don't meet the aspirations of African people. So we decided this time to come as African people, as ourselves, and write our history and tell our stories ourselves. And what is the story? The story is that of a continent that has been treated unjustly for the last couple of years. The African continent as a whole emits less than 4% of the global gas greenhouse gases, and yet the impacts of climate change are felt more in Africa than anywhere else.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on hypocrisy and double standards by Western countries regarding the utilization of fossil fuels in Africa as Europe battles an energy crisis triggered by the conflict in Ukraine. Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Africa, a victim of climate change hypocrisy. At the 27th meeting of the Conference of Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP27, held in Egypt last November, climate issues relating to Africa took center stage. Europe is facing an energy crunch, and countries in the continent are reopening coal plants. They are also actively looking to develop new sources of fossil fuel abroad, especially in Africa, where they had previously worked to block investments in the sector. Out of the 23 top investors in Africa's oil and gas projects, 14 are headquartered in the U.S., 6 in Europe, 1 in Canada, 1 in India, and 1 in South Africa.
Western countries that were calling for reduction of the use of fossil fuels before the Ukraine crisis are now financing fossil fuel expansion in Africa to fill the gap left by a halt of energy supplies from Russia. So even with Africa hosting the 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, many in the continent felt sidelined as Western industrialized countries dictated the agenda to reflect their geopolitical objectives. An activist who was frustrated at the COP27 summit speaks here.
I was so happy when they announced that COP will be in Africa, and I thought maybe we'll get a chance to be at the room where the negotiations are taking place. But today I can tell you I wasn't allowed to access the room. So I'm like, why are we here? Are we here to write around, or we are here for negotiations? So my worry is, even in Africa today, the COP is in Africa, but we have not been given a chance to speak. This is the one.
Now to discuss how Africa is a victim of climate change hypocrisy, we have contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist and author. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you, Mohamed.
We also have with us Nefta Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start off with Mr. Nimo Basse. The COP27 climate summit held last November was dubbed the African COP due to its location in Egypt. Now, did Africa get the much-touted climate justice at this summit?
The short answer is Africa did not get any sense of climate justice from the summit. And secondly, calling it an African COP was very incorrect, because this was the fifth time such a conference was being held on the African continent, and none of it had ever been an African COP. So this was just a way to lull Africans to forget that this was a time to really fight for justice. I wouldn't get any of that at the end of the day.
The COP27 ended with what was branded a historic deal to create a new fund in which countries responsible for high carbon emissions will compensate vulnerable countries suffering from climate impacts. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in a video message to COP27, said the conference has taken an important step towards climate justice, but insisted the step was not enough.
But let's be clear. Our planet is still in the emergency room. We need to drastically reduce emissions now. And this is an issue this COP did not address. A fund for loss and damage is essential, but it's not an answer if the climate crisis washes a small island state off the map or turns an entire African country to desert. The world still needs a giant leap on climate ambition.
COP27's Loss and Damage Fund for Developing Countries has been termed a breakthrough. However, many critics insist that it is just another empty climate promise.
It wasn't by any means a breakthrough. It was just a little glimmer of what could actually happen. From what we heard before and after the conference, the rich countries, industrialized nations, who have caused global warming by their polluting activities, are unwilling to accept any sense of liability or to make the loss and damage a sense of climate reparation. What they want to make it seem like is just a token, like charity. But what the developing nations, the victims, actually need now is a climate debt, which the global north, industrialized nations, do owe. And they should accept and pay a climate debt, not just paying for loss and damage while the damage continues.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has criticized Western nations' agreement to allow some fossil fuel investment while blocking Uganda's rights to retrieve oil and gas for itself as purist hypocrisy. Now, do you agree with the EU's parliament opposition to Uganda's oil pipeline project?
Well, there are a lot of contradictory signals going around in the world. The Western nations are still investing heavily in fossil fuel extraction, while at the same time acknowledging the fact that this is what is driving global warming. For us in Africa, it's also a double tragedy because our nations need a lot of financial resources, and at the same time, many of our political leaders don't care to think about the harm that comes from fossil fuel extraction. The communities in the oil fields of Uganda are really suffering. Some are displaced, and their lives have been totally shattered, and financing cannot resolve that kind of issue. So I believe it needs a lot of rethinking from both ends, from both the Ugandan, the African people, and from those who are driving expansion of fossil fuel extraction.
Now, African countries argue that they must be allowed to benefit from their fossil fuel reserves, as rich countries already have done. Now, experts say African countries are exporting their fossil fuels due to misplaced priorities.
Africa needs energy. We are not selling energy outside because we don't need it. We are selling energy outside because we have misplaced priorities.
An interesting aspect of the fossil fuel politics is that in Africa, fossil fuel exploration is extremely focused on the needs of the West. Western countries just care for their needs and do not want to see these fossil fuels being utilized for the benefit of the people of Africa.
Obviously, the global North or the Western nations have been extremely selfish in their approach to other regions of the world. What we're seeing now is a fossil colonialism, where in Africa and other regions are just seen as places to extract resources for the comfort of the West. They are unwilling to realign their lifestyles and consumption levels to the realities demanded by the need to tackle global warming. And so we're seeing a situation where the harm continues, exploitation continues, our environments continue to be trashed. And although our governments may receive some foreign exchange, may earn some foreign exchange, this can never be exchanged to what we are losing to meet the needs of the West. And up to 89% of the infrastructure, for example, for extraction of gas on African continent is all aimed for exports to the West, and this is ridiculous. The needs of Africa have to be considered, and that is not being done as at now.
Let's now bring in Nefta Freeman. Africa itself has a huge energy deficit, yet the continent's gas is mostly delivered to Western countries. Now, do you think the new dash for African gas is another manifestation of colonial exploitation?
Yeah, this is a disposition that is a legacy of colonialism. It is what characterized neocolonialism. And in fact, it's not extends beyond the use of fossil fuels, but any type of raw minerals and things that are refined into finished goods that has Africa has been used to supply the industrialized world with and make Western Europe rich and corporations and rich people rich. This extends to them. Their colonial mentality means that they want things for themselves, and they think that by virtue of domination and theft that they should be entitled to these things. Right now we're seeing also the insatiable need of, fueling modern industrialization and the war machine when it comes to fossil fuels. So modern industrialized countries, they use more fossil fuel and oil and gas than any other countries, and they get all of that from other countries, particularly in Africa right now. A lot of this is happening with Africa, and they fuel wars, and that, in fact, they go to war for it.
Well, very well put there. The current fossil fuel politics is characterized by neocolonialism perpetrated by Western powers. We'll now take a short break before we continue with our topic for today on how Africa is a victim of climate change hypocrisy. Stay with us.
Africa, a victim of climate change hypocrisy.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Africa is a continent paying for the devastating effects of a climate change crisis it did not ignite. A Somali elder elaborates here on the horrific effects of climate change. Climate change is certainly having a catastrophic impact on many African countries. Now, should the development of Africa be put on hold until the climate crisis is over?
The short answer is no. But Africa has to determine what is the type of development, what is development, and where do we want to go? If we want to go the way of the West, that's the wrong direction to take, because we can see where that has led the world now. So the issue of extracting natural resources so as to develop Africa is not really true, because right from slavery to colonialism to neocolonialism, extraction of resources on the continent have always benefited elsewhere, the other, not the region. So it's a time to really re-examine
We have the concept, the philosophy. We know what we need. We know what the people in the community, our communities require. We know the African philosophy of development, of the good life, for example. What does it mean to live well? We need to do some inward looking. Otherwise, we always fall victim to this kind of exploitation, inequity, and injustices that we're seeing in the world today.
I will put the same question to Mr. Freeman. Now, do you think Africa should reduce or stop using fossil fuels due to pressure from Western industrialized countries?
Absolutely not. The development of Africa and no other places should be put on hold until the climate crisis is saved. In fact, it can only be saved with the development of some of these places. It's the overuse, the overconsumption, the misuse by the so-called developed countries that exacerbates the climate crisis. We have to also remember that all means of eradicating poverty are actually in contradiction with advanced late-stage capitalism, neoliberalism, and the Western world. So the things that that need to happen for poverty to be eradicated are actually in contradiction or aren't antithetical to the different policies and developments or things that sustain the Western world and also at the same time exacerbate the climate crisis. So the only solution is for there to be people-centered movements for socialism, and they were talking about bottom-up movements where the global non-white working class and peasant classes depose white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy, and establish a system when we say people-centered and establishing a system that actually establishes real participatory democracy by those most impacted by these issues.
Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, says African countries are already forced to spend between 2% and 5% of their gross domestic product each year to deal with the climate change problem they did not create. This is one of the most shocking injustices against the continent.
While I don't lay much talk on measurements of the gross domestic product, I do believe that the figures being brought out by the chair of the AU actually underscores the fact of climate injustice that we all reject and campaign against. Africa is already being forced to bear the burden of tackling global warming by our forests, our resources being used either as carbon sinks or providing resources for energy for others and not for the continent. And this is something that requires real action by the African Union and other vulnerable regions who are suffering the same kind of discrimination, the kind of overloading of the responsibility of climate action. It's a time to call for a people's conference of parties and not just this routine ritual that keeps heaping more problems on the victims.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry was quoted as saying that African countries should not invest in natural gas projects. Yet, in the space of just 6 years, the U.S. LNG industry has become the largest in the world, overtaking both Qatar and Australia. Let's take a listen.
Gas could be used as a transition. And we're not saying no gas. What we're saying is that over the next few years, gas replaces coal or replaces oil, that's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas too.
Can we say that this statement by Kerry aptly captured the political position by the imperialist powers?
Well, what I would really like to ask Mr. Kerry is, does that same statement apply to the United States, or does it apply only to Africa? We need a system, a situation where justice will require that Africa follows the pattern of development that maintains our environment, that keeps our culture, and that meets our aspirations, and that no one dictates to the continent what the continent must do.
The industrialization of Western countries was made possible by the exploitation of Africa's natural resources. Just as is the case surrounding the payments of reparations for African enslavement and colonization by Europe and North America, Western powers are not accepting responsibility for the harm done in the past or the present. During the COP27 summit, Kenyan President William Ruto expressed concern that industrialized countries have defaulted in their pledges to help mitigate climate disasters.
The pledge made 13 years ago in Copenhagen, committing US dollars $100 billion annually, remains unfulfilled. Such a gracious and unexplained default is a major cause of persisting distrust, and neither is there any sound reason for the continuing pollution. In stark contrast, Kenya, a country with far less resources than the average developed country, has foregone pollution industrialization and growth opportunities and intentionally invested in clean, green energy.
Do African countries have options in compelling industrialized countries to embrace climate justice and fulfill their pledges to financially assist poor countries that are bearing the brunt of climate change?
We have to remember that the different countries also have a class composition to them. So the industrialized country, I mean, we shouldn't only see it as the embodiment of it is only the interest of their ruling classes and their elite class. So in all of the industrialist countries, there is a dispossessed working class communities, a lot of them non-white, and even in the European countries, or it's particularly in the U.S. as a settler colony. What that means is that the only hope of reparations, which actually should be seen in a more sophisticated way, is not just money payments, but the reparations is a repairing of the harms done to a people, that can only come, and particularly to African people, can only come with Pan-Africanism.
The bulk of exploration for new oil and gas resources in Africa is carried out and financed by foreign companies. Now, this has made African countries vulnerable to manipulation by Western powers. So what can Africa learn from Iran that has attained a high level of self-sufficiency in its fossil fuel projects?
Well, one of the main things it can learn is that it needs to stand up to imperialism. I mean, just to acquiesce to imperialism hasn't gotten the African countries and the comprador class, which is really serving themselves, anywhere. And in fact, another thing that it can learn from countries like Iran, but other countries, is that these countries are coming together and formations that would be tantamount to a new non-aligned movement that we saw in the 50s and the 60s, where they are not. They're saying, well, we have to look at our own interests instead of being seen as only serving the interests of either of global powers. Then we define our own interests, and in doing that, we also connect and cooperate and collaborate with other international countries to try to withstand the aggressions of imperialism. And so, this is very important for African countries to understand.
Well, there you have it. African countries should be part of the new world order that withstands the aggression of imperialism. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. I would like to thank our guests, Nefta Freeman and Nimo Basay, for their incisive analysis. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.